rather, in their stronghold of Milwaukee. Taking a look at sports, the Packers lost to the New York Jets 27-10, and on Saturday, the Badgers lost in double overtime to Michigan State 32-28. Our weather today, snow showers are likely, and as I mentioned at the outset of the newscast, light snow is falling right now in Racine. Current temperature is 38 degrees. We can expect a low tonight of 30. You're listening to WGTD News, where we have news in the morning four times an hour.
Just about every American, whether or not you're a fan of baseball, knows the name Jackie Robinson. Perhaps you don't know, but actually, Jackie Robinson much preferred to be known as Jack Robinson. And that is just one of many things that we learn about the very first African American to play Major League Baseball. We learn that and much more in this new book called Call Him Jack: The Story of Jackie Robinson, Black Freedom Fighter. This brand new book is an illuminating look at this very, very important American and someone who is still to this very day vastly misunderstood, particularly the ways in which Jackie Robinson worked very hard on behalf of the issue of civil rights and justice for all, even beyond his spectacular exploits on the baseball field. All of that and more is explored in this fascinating book published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, co-written by Michael G. Long and my morning show guest, Uhuru Williams, professor of history and former chief historian at the Jackie Robinson Foundation. And I'm honored to speak with Professor Williams for the next few minutes about his hand in this new book, Call Him Jack. Uhuru Williams, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me on.
I really am grateful for this. I have loved the book. I've learned so much from it. Ahead of us talking specifically about the book, tell us a little bit about your own personal trajectory in terms of your interest in history versus your interest in Jackie Robinson. Does this come from maybe a long-held love of baseball and or some exploits on the field, or is there some other pathway that has led you to this work that you have done?
Actually, some other pathway. Interestingly enough, Michael Long, who's my co-author, and myself are both not baseball fans. So it was kind of interesting. My love of Jack Robinson really emerged from my interest in the civil rights movement and the fact that when I was in fourth grade, I had a teacher assign a Jackie Robinson book report, which I did, and just became a fan of his. Always understood him in the context of what I imagine most Americans consider when they think about Jack Robinson, and that is his integration of baseball. And then over the years, particularly after I worked with the Jackie Robinson Foundation, read Michael Long's book, First Class Citizenship, another book by Michael that reproduced many of Jack's letters to politicians and civil rights leaders later in life, came to appreciate Jack in a very different context, someone who his entire life was committed to racial justice and acted on that impulse. And our book really is an exploration of that aspect of Jack's life.
Very good. The title, of course, is intriguing, and I've already touched on the fact that that he preferred to be called Jack rather than Jackie. But it's interesting how you and your co-author made the choice to use the name Jackie Robinson in the book's subtitle, and probably at least once I've talked about Jackie Robinson, and I think maybe you too, even at least once, have mentioned Jackie Robinson. Let's just kind of talk about that matter for a moment and how it is that he came to be known as Jackie Robinson and how difficult it is for us to, in a sense, divorce us from that name, which looms so large in American history and is yet not the name by which he wanted to be known.
Well, he actually did embrace Jackie as a nickname. But, you know, growing up, he was known as Jack. We note in the book that he signs his yearbook Jack. His friends know him as Jack. He really earns the nickname Jackie in sports. And once he's with the Dodgers, of course, that's how he's, you know, he becomes known as Jackie. And, you know, we think about kind of great sports nicknames, Pee Wee Jackie. Certainly, you know, that made sense in that context. But in terms of, you know, how he preferred to be addressed, you see this throughout most of his life. You know, he signs his letters Jack. He introduces himself as Jack. It's not that he is in any way, he finds the name Jackie repugnant. He embraces it. That becomes part of his identity, particularly when he's playing Major League Baseball. But at the core, what we try to get readers to appreciate is that at the core, Jack Robinson is the person behind Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson really is an invention. He's an invention of Branch Rickey. He's an invention of Wendell Smith. He's an invention of the media. And Jackie is a collaborator in the creation of Jackie Robinson, the myth, the guy that doesn't fight back. All the things that we kind of associate with that moment in 1947 where he and Branch Rickey embark on the enterprise of integrating the Dodgers and by extension Major League Baseball in the 20th century. But the reality is Jack was a much more complex person, and that's what we try to get to or get at in the book.
Very good. And I think you do such a marvelous job. Tell us a little bit about the collaboration between you and your co-author, Michael G. Long. Help us understand kind of the shape of that collaboration.
Well, Michael's a brilliant scholar and a wonderful co-author. It's interesting that we both met working on the Kim Burns documentary. So Michael was interviewed for the Kim Burns documentary, Jackie Robinson, and I was interviewed for that as well. I knew Michael through his scholarship, and at the Jackie Robinson Foundation, we assigned Michael's book, First Class Citizenship, of Jack's Letters to all of our scholars to give them a deeper sense of Jack's values and convictions as a person. And so I knew him through that. He actually came to know me through the Kim Burns documentary, and he, as he likes to tell people, he said, once I heard Yuhuru speak, I said, I needed to reach out to him. We needed to talk, and we needed to do a project together. And so he did that. He reached out. He's working on another book called 42 Today on the anniversary of Jack's birth, 100th anniversary of Jack's birth. And I contributed an essay to that. And in the process of us collaborating on that project, he said, look, how would you like to do, you know, a biography of Jack for young people? And he was struck, he says, by the way that I always call Jack in a documentary, Jack, not Jackie. And I picked that up really from not only reading those letters, but working with Rachel Robinson, who, you know, very rarely referred to him as Jackie, but always, at least in my presence, called him Jack. So that's how we came to work together. I was actually doing a series for a television series at the time, and Michael persuaded me it was very important that we work together on this, and I'm so glad we did. It's probably one of the works that I'm most proud of.
Hmm. I have a PDF of the book, and the PDF, unfortunately, does not contain any content on the acknowledgments page. And I wonder if we could just take a moment before we explore the story of Mr. Robinson to just have you maybe spell out what was most valuable to you and Michael G. Long in putting this book together. I mean, I'm asking about particularly resources to which you turned and also maybe people to whom you spoke that were especially valuable in helping you craft such a fine book?
Well, I think there's so many. It's such a great question. You know, we were heavily indebted to the Library of Congress and the National Archives. Certainly, as most scholars, the resources that we were able to cull there were invaluable. Also having access to Jack's papers. incredible to work with the Jackie Robinson Foundation. They were super generous. Michael had already amassed a pretty significant archive on Jack from his previous work, including Jack's letters. So that was incredibly helpful. And then I had a couple of research assistants, a couple of students from the University of St. Thomas, Bryn Kimmel and Ella Williams, who were phenomenal in helping to work on the book. So those are just a few. We were also very, very fortunate to work with the folks at FSG, Macmillan Kids. They were incredible resources as well.
It's interesting. This is we're talking, of course, in some events about many, many decades ago, and his career in Major League Baseball is roughly 70 years ago. And so in some ways it feels like relatively recent, and yet so many people you would want to speak with, of course, by now are gone.
Yes. And, you know, you feel that intimately in a way that I think particularly post-pandemic all of us can appreciate. I think historians in particular are accustomed to living in a space where you're talking about events that happened that are decades old, and you go back in search of that, and interviews can be incredibly valuable. And yet at the same time, you are looking into the faces of people who've experienced those moments, and, you know, they become portals to that moment. They can transport you back in time. As they begin to pass on, you realize what an incredible resource has been lost. And so I simply, you know, frame that in terms of 2020. We lost so many people in the last 2 years, and it was interesting in a lot of ways to be working on this project and be keenly aware of how precious life is in that sense. Jack died when he was very young of complications from diabetes and heart disease. And it's kind of interesting, you know, you think about him being such a young man and leaving such an incredible legacy, but it just reinforced this whole notion of how precious life is. And also one of Jack's mantras, which was a life is not important except in the impact that it has on other lives. One of the things that I in particular appreciated in writing about him is that he certainly used his years on the planet for the benefit of all humanity.
Certainly did. And I want to mention parenthetically, I had the pleasure of speaking with your co-author, Michael G. Long, about his book, 42 Today. And I do highly recommend that. And to our listeners, if you turn to the Morning Show archive, you will find that that interview about that book. Today we're talking about a new book called Call Him Jack. And today I'm speaking with Uhuru Williams. I appreciate so much the time you take to tell us a bit about Jackie Robinson's parents, and in particular his mother, since his father was not on the scene all that long. But there are some very, very interesting stories that date from very early in their life, when they were experiencing a difficult life working on a plantation in the Deep South. I wonder if you would share with our listeners the story of when they went to the owner of the plantation with a demand. It really says something about who they were, and the courage and resolve that they demonstrated in that moment.
It's such a great question, Greg. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I love about the Jack Robinson story is that it's actually the story of an American family. And if you kind of peel back and look at Jack's genealogy in terms of his parents, but then also in terms of his wife and his children, this really is the story of the African-American experience in America. Give you just two quick examples before I answer your question directly, but you know, we kind of focus singularly on Jack and the integration of baseball, but Jack had been integrating predominantly white spaces, segregated spaces, his entire life. Later on, when he and his family moved to Stamford, Connecticut, his kids will integrate the local school in Stamford, Connecticut, which might seem hard to believe for our listeners, but you know, we sometimes forget. We think about segregation as a Southern phenomenon, but segregation, de facto segregation, not by law, but by custom, by practice, was prevalent throughout the United States. Jack is going to integrate on the golf course in Stamford, Connecticut. In fact, he's not even going to be allowed to play in the private country club because he's black, and he's going to have to play on the public links. So it's kind of interesting that throughout his life, it didn't just stop with the integration of the Dodgers. the Robinsons as a family were pushing back against the boundaries of segregation. In terms of his mother and father, it's an interesting story early on, but they had this entrepreneurial spirit in spite of sharecropping, and were looking to, you know, get ahead and to do a little bit of side farming on their own plantation in the hopes of being able to build some wealth and to use that in order to better their lives. And, of course, under the oppressive sharecropping system, this was something that the owner of this plantation would not tolerate. And so when they go to make that request, they are, denied not only that opportunity, but it instills in Miley, Jack's mom in particular, this sense that there is no, ultimately, no hope of ever achieving anything beyond what is the bare minimum on a plantation. Once her husband, Jerry, abandons the family with another woman, it becomes clear to her that the best hope for the Robinsons is to take the Freedom train and to move. And that's how the Jack winds up in Pasadena, California, which will be where he grows up.
Hmm. By the way, in this early portion of the book, there are, and we should say throughout the book, there are sort of sidebars in which we are given important background information. And at one point, we're told something about Theodore Roosevelt, and the reason is that Jackie Robinson, his middle name is Roosevelt, and very much named after Theodore Roosevelt, because so many blacks at that time, black Americans, felt great affection for President Roosevelt for something that he had done, not realizing that beneath the surface, Theodore Roosevelt's opinions about race and specifically the African-American race were quite complicated. I think this is worth just talking about for a moment.
Not only is it worth talking about, Greg, but even in my own family, my great-grandfather, African-Americans had a great affinity for the Republican Party. The Republican Party was the party of Lincoln. And Republican presidents in particular had the adoration, you know, people, it's not like today where it would have been very evident in terms of what people were saying in private spaces thanks to social media or our 24-hour news cycle, be very easy to kind of project onto national leaders like Theodore Roosevelt a nobleness with regard to race that really wasn't there if you dug beneath the surface, and that certainly was the case with Theodore Roosevelt. But Jack Roosevelt Robinson had been named in honor of Theodore Roosevelt in the same way that my great-grandfather, William McKinley Eccles, was named. In fact, my great-great-grandmother named all three of her children for those three Republican presidents, Taft, Dewey, William McKinley, and can't get the third one out, but they were all named for the presidents, which is, you know, when I think of that story, therein is another good example of how you know, Jack's story is, you know, in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, Al Sharpton, who can be a very polarizing figure, gave this really impassioned eulogy June 4th, 2020 in Minneapolis. And he said, George Floyd's story had been the story of black folks in America. It's a quote. Well, I think Jack's story is the story of black people in America as well. And you can see that even in, as you pointed out, just naming conventions and how African Americans were trying to eke out an existence and looking for assistance and celebrating those heroes, even when flawed, who they believe were providing those opportunities. And in that case, Jack being named for Theodore Roosevelt, as flawed as he was, is a good example of that.
Eventually, as you say, the Robinson family, minus Jackie's father, who kind of abandoned the family with another woman, they eventually are part of this so-called Great Migration, and ultimately end up in California. Ultimately, after working very hard as a maid, Jackie Robinson's mother is able to buy a house, and they are the only blacks living on their block. And when you describe some of the resistance that they experienced, resistance and resentment from at least many of their white neighbors, and their resolve to remain on that block and in that house, that's an incredibly stirring example of courage.
I agree. I mean, and that's the great thing about this story we hope that readers will take away, is that it's not just what happens in 1947 between Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson that makes Jack's story significant. It is a story of courage and defiance in the face of adversity, racial animosity, which you can see early on. I mean, so Miley Robinson is able to purchase that home. It's one of the grandest homes on the block. The family, you know, pushes back against all kinds of hostility from their neighbors, including a petition that's taken to try to force them off the block. Jack himself gets in a rock battle with a neighbor after the neighbor's daughter refers to him with a derogatory racial slur. And so the Robinson family in Pasadena, it's a portrait of Pasadena that reinforces this notion that, again, racism and segregation are not confined to the South. One of the things that we love to talk about in the book is that you can see Jack in a number of ways. So here's the family, you know, integrating in that neighborhood in Pasadena. Well, in the 1930s, Jack and one of his friends, Ray Bartlett, stage an impromptu sit-in at a lunch counter in Pasadena after they're denied service. And Jack and his friend Ray decide that they are going to stay there until they're served, and ultimately are served. And, of course, that act of defiance doesn't result in the desegregation of lunch counters in Pasadena in the 1930s. But it's the reason why, much later on in 1963, when Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, is introducing Jack, or talking about Jack at the Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, he describes Jack as a sit-inner before the sit-ins and a freedom rider before the freedom rides. That's not hyperbole. He's talking about all these moments in Jack's life, going back to Pasadena in the 1920s and 1930s, talking about Jack's refusal to give up a seat on a segregated bus in Texas when he was in the military, talking about the integration of baseball, where Jack was pushing for full equality for African-Americans in all those moments, making him a pioneer of this black freedom struggle.
We're speaking with Yehuda Williams, and we're talking about the book he co-authored called Call Him Jack. Of course, Jack Robinson, Jackie Robinson, is a spectacular athlete, and your book reminds us that he was spectacular not only in baseball, but in basketball and track and football and even tennis. It's really incredible, and from a very young age. One theme that does also recur is that he was not a particularly successful student. Tell us more about this facet. Is it just simply that he wasn't as exceptional or spectacular a student as he was an athlete, or did he really struggle as a student? And help us understand this aspect of young Jackie Robinson.
Again, another great question. You know, I think Jack struggled with his studies. What accounts for that, you know, would be conjecture in some sense. We do know he switches his major to history in college because he is struggling with the math courses, and history is going to offer a little bit of an easier road in terms of the classes that he has to take. And yet, his wife, Rachel, recalls that one of Jack's greatest disappointments was the fact that he didn't finish college, didn't finish UCLA, despite being a four-letter sports person there, because of finances. And that's one of the reasons that she founds the Jackie Robinson Foundation after Jack's death in 1972, because she says, you know, I would hope that no young person would ever have to abandon their studies for this reason. So it's not that Jack isn't an intellectual. It's not that he's not a reader. It's not that he doesn't have the aptitude. Certainly later on, he'll go on to be a vice president for Chocolate Nuts, a restaurant chain in New York, and help to co-found a bank, Freedom National Bank in Harlem, to provide low-interest home ownership loans and business loans for African-Americans. But it's more so that he gets more accolades. There's more opportunity for him in sports. He's got the talent in that area, and that's where he is getting the attention. And so I guess in some sense it's normal to see a young person kind of gravitating toward those areas where they can see success. His older brother, Mac, had been his hero. Mac, of course, is in the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens, comes in second to Jesse Owens in those Olympics. And if he's looking at Mac as a role model, when Mac returns from the Olympics, he'll spend the rest of his life sweeping streets in Pasadena, occasionally wearing his Olympic jacket and his Olympic medal if he did that. So it points to the meager opportunities for African Americans. I think back to the experience of two other prominent African Americans that might, who are contemporaries of Jack, that might provide some insight into this. Malcolm X, of course, was born in the 1920s in Omaha, and he recounts in his autobiography the story of how a teacher encouraged him to essentially become a janitor. And that really was the prospects for African Americans. So Jack maximizing, particularly in middle school and high school, and then ultimately college, his athletic prowess was some indication of him recognizing that this was his opportunity, this was his shot. And that's how we think about him in the book.
Hmm. At one point, there's the line, "With his mother's guidance, Jack grew deeply proud of his blackness." And the way that plays out in these early years is really interesting. You've already touched on the dramatic day when he and a friend sat at a lunch counter and were refused service, but stayed there essentially all day until finally they were served. You also tell an interesting story about an incident that occurred at Pasadena's public pool, where black kids were only permitted to swim there on Tuesdays. Tuesdays were called International Day, and others would be permitted to swim, but otherwise that pool was only there for whites. And so young Jack Robinson and friends take to swimming in the city's reservoir, are apprehended by police, and so on. I mean, he is already showing great determination early on to resist in one way or another some of those Jim Crow laws in place. Ultimately, he becomes a rather active member of something called the Pepper Street Gang. This was something I don't remember knowing anything about. Tell us about the Pepper Street Gang and what role they played in young Jack Robinson's life.
Well, it's this colorful cast of characters. I don't know that your younger listeners will appreciate this, but they call themselves the Pepper Street Gang, but they're not a gang in the sense that we would think about gangs today. They're more akin to, again, going back a couple of generations here, our gang or the Bowery Boys. And it's just a group of essentially outcasts who live in Jack's neighborhood, African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, who also would have suffered from discriminatory action, who band together because they share, this exclusion from the mainstream. And they get into all kinds of mischief, mostly harmless fun, some mischief-making that is not so harmless, like the time they dig up, after they are insulted by a neighbor, they dig up this person's yard, and Jack's mom has to intervene and have them go back and replace the sod. But they, just Jack kind of leading this motley but colorful cast of young people in that neighborhood who otherwise would have been misfits and outcasts. The same people that he's swimming with in the reservoir are the same people who would have been denied access to the lunch counters, the same people who couldn't get a library card. And that's really what forms the bond that draws them together. So the Pepper Street Gang, again, just a really interesting way or interesting insight into Jack's personality. And the fact that he's always leading, and this is the thing that we really appreciated about telling his story, that Jack just, you can see this throughout his life. There's this desire not only to push back for himself, but for others. It always seems to be this kind of running theme for him, even from early on, that when he pushes back, it's not just about him. It's about trying to get those same opportunities for other people.
Mm. So when he was playing all these sports in high school, would he have been playing on an integrated team? And would he be facing integrated teams, in terms of opponents?
Absolutely. And that's what makes that 1947 moment so important. Most people think about Jack stepping on the field and being greeted with a hail of kind of racial insults slurs, that wasn't new to Jack. There was nothing that people were saying during his debut with the Dodgers or with Montreal that Jack hadn't heard, a million times before at UCLA, at Pasadena Junior College. He had played against white athletes. He had played at integrated teams. So this would not in any way have been foreign to him. And it's one of the things that we emphasize in the book that, it takes a tremendous amount of courage for Jack to do that. And yet at the same time, there's nothing about that that's unique, because Jack had faced that same type of animosity many, many times before.
And it's...
And what stands out is that he always performed at the highest level in spite of that.
Right. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why Branch Rickey, not to leap too far ahead, felt like Jackie Robinson was the best choice to be the first in Major League Baseball because of some of this past history. I wonder if you'd tell our listeners the story of what occurred shortly after Jackie Robinson enrolled at Pasadena Junior College. There was quite an eruption of outright hatred amongst his own teammates, and the way in which he dealt with that head on is really quite inspiring and impressive.
He's a very dignified individual, Greg. Thank you for asking that question. It's one of the things that the main reason we really wanted to target this to the audience that we did is we believe that young people in this moment are devoid of heroes who in some sense demonstrate the immortal advice that Mr. Antolini gives Holden Caulfield in J.D. Salinger's book, The Catcher in the Rye, where he tells, a young Holden Caulfield, the mark of an immature man is that he's willing to die for a cause, while the mark of a mature man is that he's willing to live humbly for one. Jack both fought back and at times lived humbly for justice and let his playing do the talking. Left you with the sense that you were dealing with somebody who you couldn't rattle, not only because he was supremely confident in himself, but because he fundamentally believed in his own self-worth. And certainly we can see, the influence of his mother on helping to create that sense of dignity, that sense of purpose that you see that is so palpable in his reaction to other incidents that, quite frankly, would have left other people, if not, angered, shaken, and put them in a position where they may not have been able to rise above that to perform in the way that Jack does. You talked about Pasadena. Again, later on, when Jack's teammates on the Dodgers take a, basically right to ownership and say, we can't play with this African-American. Jack's ability to weather that is all part of his formation early on in the way that he handled a very dignified way, similar challenges. Doesn't mean, and we emphasize this in the book, that Jack doesn't also get into some scrapes, like fighting, he gets into a pretty nasty brawl at one point after he's insulted at a meet, and he chases down a gentleman one day who hurls a racial slur at him when he's driving. So he can be a hothead, but it's this journey of watching him learn how to channel that energy in ways that are constructive that we thought was such a compelling story for young people, and why we wanted to tell the stories in the book, like Pasadena, why we wanted to emphasize those moments in his life, because they definitely, I think, illustrate for young people what it means to be contemplative in action and what it means to live humbly for justice and to recognize that sometimes the better route is to think in terms of how you can win others over by the force of your convictions as opposed to by yourself.
Absolutely. In fact, I think at one point we read in your book the term selective retaliation as something that Jack Robinson had practiced during his life. I mean, that making the choice, sometimes probably not an easy choice, to not lash out at every single instance of disrespect or worse, but in a sense, picking your battles wisely and standing your ground, in various ways, depending on the circumstances and so on. And those were probably hard-fought lessons and hard-fought wisdom that he ultimately earned.
Indeed.
You tell us at UCLA, interestingly, he really struggled in baseball, in the sport that we think of as the best of all of the many sports he played. Just say a quick word about the nature of the struggles which he had on the baseball diamond at UCLA.
Well, he struggled with his hitting in particular, and I think the interesting thing about Jack is that he was such an incredible athlete. I mean, this was true in all the sports that he played, and it's certainly true when Branch Rickey reaches out, and there's this debate, you know, in the Negro Leagues in particular, you know, was Jack the best Negro League player? The answer to that is probably no. Was Jack the best athlete? Did he bring so many other talents to the table that made him a threat in other ways? Certainly Jack was that. Football was actually, you know, his strongest sport at UCLA, and he is in the paper constantly. He plays, you know, kicker, punter, quarterback. I mean, he is dominant on the gridiron. And most people would have assumed that that would have been Jack's trajectory. But he was a heck of an athlete, and I think that's part of the kind of interesting thing. If not for the, you know, Jack's also an incredible tennis player. One thing that we don't write about in the book, but we certainly used about in the writing of the book is, imagine if that public pool had not been closed to Jack Roosevelt Robinson. We might be even talking about Jack as an Olympic caliber swimmer. He was competitive, and he just had that natural, you know, athletic ability, and he utilized that and maximized that in ways that, you know, certainly made him the best pick as an all-around athlete. He's even struggling a little bit when Clyde Tuchelforth comes out to scout him for Branch Rickey. But again, anyone could look at his kind of his speed, his instincts, his baseball IQ, but his sports IQ. It wasn't just baseball. I mean, across the board, he was just a very thoughtful player. You knew that you were getting an incredible athlete, and I think that that's what he evidenced at UCLA and all those sports, even though, as you point out, baseball was not his strongest suit at that point.
Certainly one of the most interesting passages in the book is when you talk about his experience in the U.S. Army and some of the work that he did, particularly when he was put in charge of the morale among black soldiers on his base, and some of what he did in terms of fighting against segregated seating in the dining hall and on the bus and so on, and one incident that occurs in which he is ultimately arrested and charged with insubordination, although ultimately acquitted. But I mean, here again, we really are seeing the face of a civil rights warrior, and that is so at odds with what we most often think of in terms of his persona.
I couldn't agree more, and I think this is part of the problem, the invention of Jackie Robinson, as opposed to, you know, looking at and really interrogating the life of Jack Robinson. And I think nothing encapsulates that better than what happens on that Texas bus in 1944. Jack is returning home, suffering from an ankle injury, and he's on this bus, and he sits down next to a friend of his, a light-complected woman of color, who the driver assumes is a white woman. And the driver immediately demands that Lieutenant Robinson immediately remove himself to the back of the bus for violating, you know, the spoken and unspoken code of, you know, blacks at the back of the bus and no undue familiarity with white women in particular. Jack, of course, had read that there was to be no segregation on Army posts. During the Second World War, of course, the United States was at war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, both of which are pushing racial regimes. I think in the case of everyone familiar with the Nazis more so, this notion of white supremacy and master race. And when the United States tries to challenge that diplomatically, the answer comes back resoundingly from Germany and from Japan. The nerve of you to talk about us, look at the system of segregation in the United States. And so the U.S. Army has to combat that. They can't do that by wiping out segregation in every southern hamlet and village. They can do it by saying there's to be no segregation on U.S. Army bases, and Jack is familiar with that. So he refuses to give up his seat. The driver is infuriated by this. So a woman on the bus demands that the police be called, and the driver uses a racial slur against Jack. When the police come, they ask Lieutenant Robinson why he didn't remove himself, and at that point they claim that Jack had used a curse word. And so he is arrested and goes through court-martial proceedings. Now, I want to be very clear, Greg. If this does not go in Jack's favor, he's not integrating the Dodgers with French Rickey 3 years later in 1947, because he would have been branded a criminal. And it would have been very easy for his detractors to point to this incident as an example of him not being worthy. You know, this would have been evidence of the so-called criminal nature of black people and why they didn't deserve the opportunity to play in sports. But when Jack goes before that court-martial review board, he's able to point to not only those orders that came out from Washington with regard to no segregation on Army bases, but when he's asked squarely by the tribunal why he challenges being called, and it was the N-word, unfortunately, why he even called that, Jack says, because my grandmother taught me that that word refers to a low and uncouth person. I don't consider myself uncouth. I don't consider myself low. I don't consider myself an N-word. Really powerful testimony. And Jack is able to, the tribunal ultimately finds in Jack's favor, and there is no court martial. He musters out of the Army with an honorable discharge. But that is one of those moments where, again, Jack is fighting for himself, but by extension, fighting back for others and demanding. You know, if we're going to fight for the United States, we demand the same dignity and respect afforded to other Americans who are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And he demonstrates that on that Texas bus and in the proceedings against him in court martial.
That's it's an incredible story, and again, one largely unknown to most of us. Ultimately, your book, of course, takes us into the professional baseball career of Jackie Robinson, first with the Negro Leagues and then into the major leagues. And of course, most of us know at least something of that story of Branch Rickey and so on, and we learn more from your book. I want to have you tell our listeners about a dramatic and meaningful moment that occurs when he's still a minor leaguer with the Montreal Royals. And actually, I think this occurred in his very first game with the Royals, in which he hits a very dramatic home run. Your book tells the amazing story of who greeted him as he came into home plate, his first minor league home run, a dramatic moment and some courage shown by one of his teammates, George Shuba.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's in Jersey City, of all places, and it's a little bit of a holiday. Everybody's eyes are on Jack. And the question is, how will he, you know, perform in this game? Of course, he's nervous. Rachel's nervous. And African-Americans come from, you know, far and wide to see this game. In fact, the mayor of Jersey City closed the school. It's a little bit of a holiday. They've done that every year, but it takes on an even more important tone, because this is going to be Jack's minor league debut with Montreal. But he hits this home run, and, you know, in the hitting of this home run, of course, African-Americans in the field are up. I mean, they know that Jack is capable. But there was always this question, would Jack be accepted by white fans? People knew that there was going to be pushback, that there would be animosity. But the question is, could they get behind somebody who was performing, and could they celebrate his success? But more intimately, the question is, could his teammates do that? Could his coaches do that? And when Shuba walks out to greet him and extends his hand, I think that answered that question in a very dramatic way. Everybody focuses on the kind of apocryphal story of whether Pee Wee Reese actually put his arm around Jack, and Ken Burns has debunked that to a large extent. But this Shuba moment is real, and it is powerful, because, you know, here's Shuba in some sense saying, you know, as long as you're performing, you're one of us. And we're with you. It was a really powerful moment.
And you have a photograph of it in the book, that moment when George Shuba is extending his hand to his teammate. I so appreciated learning about that moment. And of course, your book goes on to chronicle Jackie Robinson's career with the Brooklyn Dodgers, the amazing things that he does, despite the sort of dual identity of being Jack Robinson and Jackie Robinson, the gentle, non-threatening, dignified gentleman, trying to wear both of those hats, both of those personas simultaneously. Your book explores that to such an interesting, meaningful extent. And, of course, beyond that, then the civil rights work that Jackie Robinson does after his Major League Baseball playing days are over. Ultimately, I suspect that the closer you looked at this man and his life, the more you came to admire him.
I think that's true. I fell in love. It's interesting because Michael and I talk about this a lot. The moment at which you, as a biographer, historian, simply as a fan, you come to appreciate athletes in a very abstract place in terms of what they do on the field. And we're often disappointed when we're exposed to them in other arenas. We, in some sense, kind of lose, you know, predictably the awe that goes along with watching somebody hit a home run, went down three, or score the winning touchdown, or shoot the winning basket. There's none of that with Jack. You're almost as awestruck with him off the field. In fact, more so. And you walk away from, hopefully readers will walk away from reading this book saying, he's a complex human being, and there's beauty in complexity. And we need to get back to celebrating the beauty and complexity. Jack wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but he was the best human he could be. And it's why I think I've grown to admire him even more, because there's so much that you can draw from his life and experiences that can be inspiring in our contemporary moment, inspiring in our own lives. And so, yeah, I think I came away with not only a much deeper appreciation of Jack the person, but also a real desire to share this his story with as many young people as possible to hopefully inspire that same sense of accomplishment in them.
Call Him Jack, The Story of Jackie Robinson, Black Freedom Fighter, is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and the co-author, Yehuru Williams. Thank you so much, Professor Williams, for helping to craft this marvelous book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I so enjoyed it and loved the book. Best wishes to you.
Thanks again, Greg. Take care.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be joined in the studio by James Schatzman, who is Artistic Director of the Racine Choral Arts Society. He'll be talking about their upcoming concert. In part two, Dr. Christina Laporte talks about her novel, Dissection. On Wednesday, I'm happy to welcome back into our studios Rachel Swartz from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. The Parkside Theater Department's current production, which is about to open, is Sarah DePepp's The Wolves. On Thursday, John Hambrock and Anne Morse Hambrock, who both have a hand in the wonderful comic strip The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. Recently, they received a thrilling honor, the Silver Ruben for newspaper comic strips from the National Cartoonist Society. This is essentially the Oscar for newspaper comic strips. So we'll be talking with them about this wonderful moment in the history of The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. And on Friday, it's Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. She'll be joined by John Zaborski, who is a research associate with the Wisconsin State Herbarium. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the archived Morning Show on our website, wgtd.org. And you can subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast to hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.